I'd like to welcome you to our session, After the War, What's Next for Afghanistan and Pakistan. My name is Neil Jock. I'm a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Institute for International Studies and the moderator today. We're recording the first hour of the session for radio broadcast, so please make use of the blue question cards on your seats, and we will incorporate them into the question and answer portion of the session. We'll then open the last 15 minutes of the session for questions directly from the floor, and we'll pass a microphone around for that. We have two distinguished guests with us this morning to speak on the topic. Ambassador Mark Grossman, in the middle of your panel, is the vice chairman of the Cohen Group and former U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. To your extreme right, Ambassador Cameron Munter is now a professor of international relations at Pomona College and former U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan. After over a decade of war, U.S. troops are scheduled to withdraw from Afghanistan by the end of the year. Specific troop levels are yet to be determined, as President Karzai has delayed approving a status of forces agreement, without which President Obama has said the U.S. will need to consider the so-called zero option of removing all U.S. troops at the end of this year. ISAF commanding General Joseph Dunford recently warned that in such an event, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are poised to return to their pre-war, pre-9/11 positions in Afghanistan, thereby again posing a significant threat to U.S. security. The questions for us today, therefore, include whether Afghan forces are able to maintain peace and will be able to build a stable democratic government, whether we will see a renewed civil war, as happened following the Soviet withdrawal in the 1980s. Many believe that stability in Afghanistan depends on Pakistan and vice versa, and Pakistan is seen as a key player in coordinating peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. So, what does the future hold for these neighboring countries? Let me begin by turning to Mark Grossman.
Good. Neil, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming, Cameron. Nice to see you. If I could just thank all the organizers of this event and thank them very much. I had the good fortune for a couple of years to be the chairman of the National Board of World Affairs Councils of America. So, I thank you all very much for your interest in World Affairs Councils all around the country and for being here today. You know, I really appreciate the chance to talk a little bit about Afghanistan, and then obviously I turn to Cameron, who's much more expert than I am on the question of Pakistan. All of the questions that you've asked seems to me kind of get to the heart of the trouble that all of us are having in thinking about Afghanistan at the moment. In other words, how do you think about Afghanistan? Do you think about Afghanistan and focus in on the latest Taliban attacks against our forces, Afghan forces, friends, allies, Afghan civilians? Or do you focus in, as Neil said, on the fact that the Afghan National Security Forces, the Afghan Army, the Afghan police, are actually holding up pretty well, can fight, are interested in fighting, are interested in protecting their country? Do you kind of consider that Afghanistan's endemic poverty is just going to be that way forever? Or do you consider the question that a couple of weeks ago, the UN Development Program, UNDP, you know, and they have this human development network or human development criteria, said that Afghanistan had made more progress on human development than any other country in the world over the past 3 years? Or finally, do you take the kind of public comments that you hear from President Karzai, his anger at the United States, or do you kind of listen to the many, many Afghans who recognize that the progress that they have made since 2001, 2002, 2003, is a result of the huge sacrifice that we have made, our allies have made, our friends, our partners have made, but also Afghans have made as well. And so I think people accurately and rightly, and I include myself in this, you know, don't know sometimes how do you judge what's going on in Afghanistan. I think a really important thing to do, though, first is to recognize that Afghanistan is not the same country that it was in 2001, 2002, 2003. Recent polls by the Asia Society, Asia Foundation, show that 76% of Afghans, you know, think they're better off economically than they were in the past. 67% of Afghans think their country's going in the right direction, which is certainly a higher number than you'd get in the United States of America. And I'll give you a couple of other statistics as well, and I promise this is the only reading I will do to you. But you got these numbers that I hope you'll keep in mind. In the year 2002, there were 900,000 Afghan children in school. They were all boys. And there are 10.5 million Afghan children in school today, 40% of whom are girls. 3,000 women-owned businesses. Access to health service rising from 9% in 2001 to 60% today. Life expectancy for Afghans was 42 years in 2003. It's 62 years today. GDP growth, 9% a year. A number I love, in 2001, there were 21,000 mobile phone subscribers, cell phone subscribers in Afghanistan. There are 16 million cell phone subscribers today. A country that in 2002, 50 kilometers of paved road, 2,500 kilometers of paved road today. Three women out of 25 cabinet ministers, 68 of 249 seats in the National Assembly held by women, 50 television stations, 150 radio broadcasts, 1,000 newspapers, and 500,000 Afghans on Facebook. So it's not the same country that it was in 2003, and the question that Neil rightly poses is, can they maintain this effort? And sometimes I think if you were Afghan and you were in Kabul and we were all having this conversation, the question you'd be asking is, will the international community now support us in our fight? It's not, it's not America's fight anymore, but will they support us in our fight? And I think Afghans will fight for what they've achieved since 2001 and 2002, 2003. And the question to us will be, do we have the patience and the courage to support them in their fight? And so what I give you is four points that you might consider over the next few months as you watch what's going on in Afghanistan. Point number one is what happens on the 5th of April in the election that's going to take place. You know, President Karzai will leave office. New Afghan president will be elected in the first round of elections on the 5th of April. A year ago, 2 years ago, I think anyone who was working on Afghanistan would have said, ooh, this isn't going to go very well. A lot of challenges. Who knows whether these challenges can be met. But I must say that everyone who's come back from Afghanistan over the past few months, everybody who's traveled there, who knows anything about elections, is thinking that these elections will be meet some modest standard. So it's a modest standard of transparency, of fairness, and most importantly, they'll meet a standard of legitimacy. In other words, when they're over, will most Afghans believe that the person who's president is seen by legitimate and by the majority of Afghans. So what happens the 5th of April is really important. I'd say it's important for three other reasons. One is it'll send to us a message of what kind of future support we may wish as the United States to give to Afghanistan. Secondly, it'll send a message to the Taliban that the people of Afghanistan are prepared to have a government and that the Taliban may over time recognize that war, perpetual war, not the answer to this question. And third, for Afghans themselves, first time in Afghan history, period, that they'd be a peaceful transfer of power from one president to another. So April 5, that's the first thing that I give you. Second, as Neil said, watch what happens now about this bilateral security agreement, what you and I mostly know as a status of forces agreement. And this BSA, the bilateral security agreement, came out of the strategic partnership agreement that we signed with the Afghans in May of 2012. And no American president, not a Republican, not a Democrat, could leave American forces in Afghanistan without a status of forces agreement, without a BSA. It's negotiated, it's ready. President Karzai has so far refused to sign. And I think the administration has now done the right thing, which is to say, well, if Karzai's not going to sign, we'll sign it with the next person. Because all 10 of the presidential candidates have said they'll sign this agreement if they are elected. I give you my personal opinion. My personal opinion is, I hope the BSA will be signed sometime soon. I hope that our president will decide to keep in the neighborhood of 10,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan for some years to come, that 5,000 international forces will join them for the purposes of continuing to train the Afghan National Security Forces and also to do some counterterrorism work. And I think that'd be enough to do the military job and also to provide some confidence to the Afghans. But the BSA, then, is the second thing I offer to you. Third thing is to keep focused on the economy. You know, one of the things that struck me whenever I visited Afghanistan, and if Cameron would allow me Pakistan as well, is what's needed there over time is sustainable economic development. And that's why Secretary Clinton and now Secretary Kerry have promoted this idea of a new Silk Road, of trying to connect Central Asian economies with South Asian economies, with Afghanistan and Pakistan in the center. But I don't think this money over time and forever is going to come from taxpayers in the United States or Europe or anyplace else. And that is, there's going to have to be a shift now to private sector development in Afghanistan. I think that's possible, but it's something that we ought to always be judging about whether there's more of that rather than less. Now, we've made some commitments to the Afghans on the official development side from Tokyo in 2012. America, our friends, our allies, partners, others, pledged $4 billion a year in 12, 13, 14, and 15 for Afghan development. And I hope that money moves from pledges to real dollars. But after that, those money's going to go down. And so the private sector is a hugely important part of the future answer in Afghanistan. And finally, there's the question of Pakistan. I think as Neil very properly said, the Pakistanis play a big role in what happens in the future in Afghanistan. It was my observation, I think shared by Cameron, that sometime in the middle of 2012, the Pakistanis started to recognize that chaos in Afghanistan, bad for them. They, of course, have a new government, but what they do is extremely, extremely important, not just to the questions of how things move forward here, but in their own society. Finally, one other point, I'm sorry if you'd allow me, and that is what happens to a peace process? In other words, can we get to a point where Afghans can talk to other Afghans about the future of Afghanistan? And those of you who follow this know that we tried in 2011, 2012, all of us, Cameron, myself, everybody, to try to open the door for the government of Afghanistan to speak to the Taliban. Didn't work, but I think you and I can recognize that this war isn't going to end militarily, it's going to end politically. Someone is going to get back into this conversation with the Taliban. That responsibility belongs to Afghans, but I think the United States has a role in continuing to try to open that door. So I say those things. What happens the 5th of April? What happens to the BSA? What happens on the economic side? What happens on the peace process? And obviously what happens between Afghanistan and Pakistan are the things you ought to be using to judge how you answer the question about what's going on in Afghanistan today and in the near future. With that, I thank you very much and give you to Cameron Munter.
Yeah. Mark, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. I asked them, both speakers, to briefly introduce key points over 10 minutes to allow full time for question and answers afterwards. Mark, you hit it right on target. Cameron, over to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Imagine how difficult it is when you're working with Mark with that kind of discipline, that kind of clarity. We all struggle to catch up, but that's the problem of being in the field when you have that kind of excellent support at home. One just brief note on Afghanistan and a couple of points I'd like to make about Pakistan that can do the same thing, try to actually just inspire a little thought on this. I think that the issue of reconciliation that Mark raised is just one that's very much in the mind of Pakistanis, but indeed in the mind of those in the region, and I'll come back to the notion of the region as well, that the reconciliation is not just a process of ending the war and bringing people who are military opponents to the table. If there is to be a democracy to build on the social structure changes, the monumental changes that Mark has talked about, there also has to be a kind of a democratic structure which actually has an opposition. That is to say, if the 10 candidates who are running in Afghanistan right now, if any of them is elected, Mark hinted at the fact that there's a certain amount of unanimity among them, a certain amount of pride about what's been achieved and a certain vision of the future. The Taliban don't share that future. And by Taliban, I'm speaking generally of those people in the opposition. At the point in which that choice, people who have different visions for Afghanistan, are brought into the political process, that to me is where politically you're going to have an Afghanistan that has a strong future. Indeed, I think that question is going to be one of the key Afghan questions. The other one is the question of governance. Despite the very real progress that's been made, it's generally accepted that the problem is not that new schools have come, that the little girls are being educated, that health hasn't expanded. It's that the faith in this new government will depend not only on the legitimacy of the elections, but also on the ability to govern. And that is the other key challenge, which, as Mark said, it's not going to be something we can do for them. It can be something we hope they will do without governance, without the feeling that the government is serving the people. It's going to be very difficult. Among the Pakistanis, the key neighbor here for Afghanistan, I think that I'd like to talk a little bit about strategy, about domestic politics, and then about the U.S.-Pakistan relation. Those of you who know that one of the problems historically that Pakistan has had is that it has looked at Afghanistan as they call it the strategic depth, the country that would allow it to have the strategic flexibility to deal with an Indian attack, which they see as the kind of fundamental existential question for Pakistan, whether India and Pakistan can get along. What Mark alluded to, that in 2012 and maybe in a longer period, that some changes are taking place in Pakistan, I believe that that question of the existential threat to Pakistan from India may not have changed, but even in the military, which is in fact where a lot of this debate goes on, there is a debate going, there's taking place in which Pakistan is, many Pakistanis are beginning to see or have begun to see that the militant threat that they share in a way with Afghanistan, the threat to the institutions of secular Pakistan, to the institutions of secular Afghanistan, is the existential threat to Pakistan. I believe that is changing. It doesn't mean that the problems with India have gone away, but within the military there is a debate now about whether or not the future of Pakistan lies in resisting India, or rather whether the future of Pakistan and its stability lies in dealing with the threat on its border. If the national security leadership of Pakistan is able to make that commitment, I think that will begin to allow relationships between Afghanistan and Pakistan to come to another level, to be able to look at a common threat, rather than to disagree about whose fault it is that certain soldiers are coming back and forth, irregulars are coming back and forth across the Durand line. So I'm cautiously optimistic that the leadership of the national security state in Pakistan is at least debating that question, the question about whether or not the existential threat to Pakistan is indeed India or whether it's the jihadis. In this sense, because that is an incomplete debate, we do face a real problem that I would flag for you post-2014. If we are not able to have a robust presence in Afghanistan, if the worst possible case happens, even with or without a BSA, we don't want to see the remnants of old ideas in Pakistan, the idea of encirclement, that somehow Afghanistan on one side and India on the other encircle Pakistan, that could possibly lead to tension between India and Pakistan, not on their border in the east, but in Afghanistan itself. This is something I think that we have to be careful about, and as we think regionally, that we, the friends of Pakistan, the friends of Afghanistan, also engage with India, with China, with other countries to try to minimize the prospect of a misunderstanding or an incident that could push Pakistani and Afghan relations backwards. So there's a kind of a strategic debate going on that is not complete in Pakistan, but I'm optimistic that this debate could bring Pakistan beyond the kind of old-fashioned notions that have imprisoned it for so many years. Secondly, domestically in Pakistan, there is the problem that even though the Dalai Lama says change comes from within, I don't have a lot of faith that the political parties in Pakistan will be capable of major change. One of the reasons the phenomenon of Imran Khan, the ex-cricket player, why he has come up and why he has become so much of a symbol of change, even though in many ways he can't articulate what that change would be, is people in Pakistan, especially the educated elites, are tired of the fact that they're ruled by a semi-feudal system. They're tired of the fact that their options are so limited that, as one general once said to me, why must my child grow up in a country where the only options are to have a Bhutto or a Sharif to rule me? You know, we wouldn't have that in America. We don't have Bushes and Clintons, right? We don't have dynasties here. No, the point I want to make is that there is a certain stasis in society in Pakistan, and I don't think that reform within these parties, I haven't seen evidence that that's going to take place. So while there's a debate in the military, there is not enough of a debate about domestic reform in Pakistan, and that too then, I believe, will look to the outside. The key element that would be allow us to have a Pakistan whose economy becomes more stable and on a worldwide footing can compete, because there's a lot of talent in Pakistan, but it doesn't compete internationally. The way to do that will be if Pakistan can open to India. And again, that's that attitude that needs to change, seems to be changing, that Pakistan's future is involved in being tied into its neighbors, and indeed that economic reform can come from its contact with India, with other countries, to globalize and change the social calcification that is so strong in that country. So you have that question domestically. And up till now, the new government of Nawaz Sharif, it seems to be open to this kind of reform, but it has hesitated. It has gone slowly. And many people who had big hopes maybe a year ago are beginning to wonder whether it has the will to move ahead. And that's an accurate problem that we don't know if these old structures have the will to move ahead. Finally, on U.S.-Pakistan relations, when the United States and Pakistan have talked about the region, despite the valiant efforts of many people, including Mark, and including Jim Dobbins, the current SRAP, and Richard Holbrooke, Mark's predecessor, we really never were able, it seemed to me, to find with our Pakistani friends the right way to talk about Afghanistan and the right way to find some sort of consensus. When we would give our responses to their strategic studies, we would talk more about the constitutional elements of how does Pakistan look, how does Afghanistan look. They would look much more at a kind of a cultural, anthropological question, thinking somehow that we would tell them, well, who's going to win in Afghanistan? Who have you chosen as your proxy in Afghanistan? Who's going to win? We kept saying, no, we have a structure in mind in which the Afghan people choose. And we never really had a meeting of minds about how to deal with the future of Afghanistan, or indeed how to talk about reform throughout the region. And I sadly can't claim that we've somehow achieved this. I think we have enormous misunderstandings. I don't like to admit that I went to Pakistan, the relationship went straight to hell, and I then left, and it has slowly been recovering. We don't believe in causality in that way. But I would just have to say we have a long way to go, not just on the substance of questions, but in the way we deal with each other. I would hope that what we have agreed with our Pakistani friends is that in the wake of the departure of Musharraf in 2008, we perhaps had a little bit too much optimism about what could be achieved, that we can be a little more modest now in the future about what we can do, and that the people who are acting, again, as Mark mentioned, might not be the traditional actors of American diplomacy. So in addition to government, that we would also show the best face of America after 2014, the best face of American business, the best face of American philanthropy, the best face of American higher education, so that the strength of American society and the strength of Pakistani society teaches us perhaps a new way to deal with each other. Because my final point is, we really have to make sure we get this right and to decide what our priorities are. Much as it is understandable that American leaders have wanted to get Afghanistan right, after all, our soldiers are there. And when your soldiers are in harm's way, you want to get it right. But I would submit to you that a country that has 200 million people and nuclear weapons is perhaps the country we really have to get right, and that's Pakistan. I don't mean to say we don't want to get Afghanistan right. But if we don't get Pakistan right, if we don't learn how to talk with Pakistan, we have a lot bigger problems, and those problems extend beyond Pakistan's borders to China, to Iran, to India. So I hope that what we can do in addition to seeing these changes within Afghanistan, seeing changes within Pakistan, is that we will see changes in our own approach, looking more multilateral, more regionally, and also making sure that we have more social links below the political level, so that the face of America that we show not only to Pakistan, but I would submit even to Afghanistan, is a broader question, not cramped as it has been in recent years, merely by the counterterrorist fight. So thank you.
Cameron, thanks very much. Not surprisingly, we've had a number of questions already from the floor, so let me begin with one directed at Ambassador Grossman. Given the statistics that you cited, Mark, they seem to show fairly positive improvement in daily life and infrastructure for Afghans. Why is there not stronger support by Afghan leadership for continued U.S. presence?
A good question. I think actually there is support for U.S. presence by most Afghans except for President Karzai. And of course, what we hear is what he says. So he's interviewed on the BBC, he's interviewed by the New York Times, and he says, here's my message to the United States of America, anger to the government, thanks to the people. I think you can see in other parts of Afghan society a recognition that they continue to need international support for some time to come, and that the organizer of that international support will be the United States of America. I think it's really important to point out, as Cameron did, that although these statistics show real progress, there's a huge amount of challenges there yet to come. Governance, security, you know, making sure that some of these challenges for the full participation of women in society, those things are still out there to be done. And so I think that there's a considerable sentiment in Afghanistan that they continue to need this international support to get this job done. So my message is, you have to listen to President Karzai. He's the president of Afghanistan. But I don't think he represents, on this particular question, the largest element of Afghan society.
Cameron, I wonder, that question was directed at Mark and specifically on Afghanistan, but there are a lot of questions with respect to Pakistan popular attitudes toward the United States, toward Americans. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Well, I certainly keep rolling out some statistics that I've heard in the past, and they are the kind of things that you wonder when you speak to senators and they say, why do we give money to these people if they don't like us? To polling data that says that American popularity in Pakistan is in single digits. There is no doubt that the way in which we present ourselves, kind of a mirror image to what Mark is talking about with President Karzai, that is, you hear certain things that seem to come out of America about focusing on counterterrorism. That rhetoric that we have used, which is honest and real, it appears to many Pakistanis to be something from America that talks about what America cares about, but it doesn't seem to talk about to them to talk about what they care about. That's partly a failure of the Pakistani media, and it's partly a failure of our own that we haven't really fallen into the right groove of communicating. But I would point to a different statistic that I think is more telling and makes much the same point that Mark made about Afghanistan, which is if you ask Pakistanis, and this goes across linguistic, ethnic, demographic, age lines, would you like a better relationship with the United States? The numbers hover between 90 and 95%. So this is not a country that looks at us and says, get out of here. This is a country that feels extraordinarily disappointed, sorrowful, has great expectations of us that for whatever reason it thinks we have not lived up to. Whether that's fair or not, that is what they think. What that indicates to me is that there's an enormous reservoir of affinity that Pakistanis have for Americans if we can find the right way to talk with one another about the future. It isn't easy in the middle of this conflict. I would like to think that if the conflict goes into a new phase, God willing, that if there's a reconciliation that lessens the level of violence, that we'll find a way to talk to Pakistan in which that which Pakistani public wants, a better relation with us, with our society. You know, they want to send their kids to Berkeley. They don't want to send their kids to Beijing University, right? That we can play on that possibility in the future, and we can then turn around the question of why is there single-digit support for U.S.-Pakistani relations.
Could I just add one of the things,
please.
Just to let you know, that one of the things that Cameron led and I was glad to support while he was the ambassador, we now have with Pakistan the largest Fulbright program in the world. And I think that's the kind of specific policy that he promoted that we tried to support, which over the long term, that's not a short-term policy, but over the longer term starts to open up some of these possibilities.
Just a quick plug for Berkeley. Berkeley has expanded substantially its Pakistan program as well. And the Berkeley Urdu language program in Pakistan that after September 11 had been moved to Lucknow, India for concerns of safety has now been moved back to Pakistan, an indication of renewed confidence in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And I suspect that that goes back to some of Cameron's work. Let me ask another question, and one of our audience members tried to link it to what Tom Friedman said in his presentations yesterday. Tom Friedman said yesterday that President Karzai has been running a criminal racket. What are your views on this? A connected question to that is much of the economy, and you did emphasize that, appears to run on drug dollars. Can this ever change, and does it matter? And so since you cited the election on April 5th as being critical, to what extent is this a problem associated with Karzai, and to what extent will it persist with a new leader?
Well, I mean, first of all, everyone should say out loud, as I did in my short presentation, is that corruption is a huge problem in Afghanistan. And I think that will continue after the 5th of April, because the way Afghanistan has been governed and the way the enormous amount of international money has poured into Afghanistan, that corruption is a really big problem there. And so one of the main talking points of the Taliban is, look at this government of Afghanistan, it's so corrupt, we need to come back. And we need to take that talking point away from the Taliban. So these anti-corruption measures will have to continue. One of the things that we worked on most closely was a terrible scandal called the Kabul Bank in 2011-2012. $900 million of small depositors, you know, was gone, was looted. A lot of apartments got bought in Dubai. It was a terrible thing. But little by little by little, people started to be prosecuted for those things. They recovered a tiny amount of the money. But I think Afghans themselves, as I said before, would like to see, as Cameron said as well, stronger governance and this question of corruption, I think, has got to be high up on the list. Second, on the economy. Yes, there's still a huge challenge with narcotics in Afghanistan, although it's now kind of more geographically located. But 90% of those narcotics go into Europe. And so there's a demand question. There's a supply question. But one of the things is we're going to have, one of the reasons I keep emphasizing this effort of the private sector is, in the end, the only way to get people to shift is when they have an alternative, when they can make an equal or more amount of money doing something else, one, and two, when society is then clamping down on the production of drugs. And so that's the reason to be focused on the, among the reasons to be focused on the economy, among the reasons to be focused on the private sector. So still a huge problem. It contributes enormously to the corruption problem. And something else it contributes to is to the Taliban. Because who do you think makes the money off this deal? And there are estimates that the Taliban takes in, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year by taxing the drug trade, by participating in the drug trade. So we're, in a sense, kind of supporting our own enemies here by having this go to Europe be a demand problem. So both huge problems, both corruption and the drugs.
And do you think it will persist after Karzai?
Corruption?
The general problem, yeah.
Well, sure it will, because it's now become a social question. And you know, the change of one person isn't going to solve all of Afghanistan's problems. The issue is whether this next person is legitimate to start to take some of these questions on. And that's the really important thing.
Cameron.
If I could comment and build on something Mark has said, all the solutions he's talking about, the ones that I'm mentioning as well, involve an attitude change on the part of Americans and other friends of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that is that all of these solutions are long-term questions. Americans are famous for their patience and their wisdom and their ability to think long term. You know, this is the issue. This is the issue, is that when we are dealing with the immediate, the very real, important immediate, you know, counterterrorism is nothing to be, it's not a trifle. But if we're going to get to these long term questions of the stability and the prosperity of the countries in the region, our attitude is going to have to be something more than just what happens immediately. Our attitude is going to have to be something, you know, we hate to meddle in the internal affairs of the United States as former diplomats, but we have to approach this question looking 5, 10, 15 years down the road, having policies that are funded 5, 10, 15 years, looking at institutions. Again, I mentioned universities or philanthropies that have investments that go over long periods of time, because this will not turn around tomorrow. You will not get rid of corruption tomorrow. And if you think that by throwing money at a problem and giving yourself 18 months to solve it, you're going to solve it, you're just wrong. So we can contribute also by rethinking the way that we commit ourselves in the future to Afghanistan and Pakistan going long term.
One question was raised that I think we should pursue a little bit, and let me read part of it and then expand a bit. Do you think the advancement in women's education and roles in society in Afghanistan can be sustained post-Karzai, post-U.S. engagement? And the follow-on part to that question is, and how will it impact women's rights in other countries? And that, I think, really is something that Cameron might be able to comment on. Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
I am optimistic about this. I think it can be sustained. I think it can be sustained because I believe Afghans will fight for what it is they've achieved. And I think about it in this way. And you may consider this simplistic, but allow me this. So if it's right that there were 900,000 children in school, all boys, in 2003. And there are 10 million kids in school today, 40% of whom are girls. And the Taliban's propaganda is, knock, 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 we're back. We're going back to 2001, 2002, 2003. So if you're the parent of one of those kids in between 900,000 and 10 million, are you going to say, oh, okay? Or will you say, no, actually, I like the fact that there's education and my daughter has a chance to be educated? There are 3,000, as I said in my presentation, 3,000 women-owned businesses in Afghanistan. And I will tell you, from having visited Afghanistan a fair number of times, the most interesting people you meet in Afghanistan, bar none, are female entrepreneurs. So knock, 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 comes the Taliban, we're coming back. Are these 3,000 women and the people they employ just going to say, okay, we're going back? I don't think so. Now, that could be wrong. You never know what's going to happen. But I think the evidence is that the Afghan National Security Forces will fight, and that the people in Pakistan who have seen some development, seen some change, and that's not everybody, but those people who have seen some development, seen some change, will fight for what they have achieved. Our responsibility here, it seems to me, is to do what we can to support them in their fight. And that means to keep focused on these women's issues, to keep focused on the support for the ANSF, to keep, as Cameron said, a long-term view on the economy. We can't kind of change this as Americans. Afghans have, this is an Afghan problem. Afghans have to live their lives. But do we have a chance to kind of, at the edges, help them kind of move in a direction which they seem to want to go themselves? Yes, I think we do. Now, again, I want to be clear here that there are enormous challenges yet to come in Afghanistan, and particularly in the issue of women's rights and women's capabilities. But is it a different place than it was in 2003? Yes, it is. And are there things that we can do to keep that going in the right direction? Yes, there are. Is this ultimately, though, for Afghans to decide? Yes, it is.
Commenting briefly on Pakistan, it, in a way, even more troubling in Pakistan, because those of you who know the long-term trends in Pakistan, many years ago, women were more empowered. And it does seem that in the years since General Zia and then beyond into the present, that they have gone backwards in their rights. And there's no way around that. I would argue that the coming to that question, the question of women's rights, women's empowerment, and the role of women in society, we may have been doing ourselves a disservice by looking specifically at the role of women rather than looking at the role of women in the societies where they live. We do have a habit, and I think take this as a self-criticism, we have a habit of putting together in our government-to-government or government assistance, we look for women's programs. We find a strong woman in a village. She sets up a school. We make a documentary. It's very heartwarming. What about the men? You know, are we trying to work within the context of the families that these women come from? Can we have a little more understanding of the fact that a woman's future, the child, you don't just want a little girl to go to school, you want the little girl's dad to care about the little girl going to school. And in that sense, we have to be able to reach out with a little bit more sensitivity, I think, in our assistance programs, to the idea of the rural sociology within which these girls live, so that we not only educate them, but we find a place in society for them that is accepted by religious leaders, accepted by political leaders, and the men with whom they live. We haven't always done a good job of that, and part of the reason why there has been this problem of the kind of backsliding in Pakistan is that those people who provide an alternative to a perceived corruption or perceived inability of government are people who themselves don't have a good vision or at least a clear vision of women in society. We can help our Pakistani friends, our Afghan friends in the region, if I think we take a little bit more of a holistic approach to development where women fit in with society rather than trying to single them out.
Could I just make a larger point, if I could, maybe to the larger conference, and Cameron makes a really important point that I'd just like to build on. I mean, one of the kind of themes of the conference, one of the themes in America today is, you know, how do people look at us? How do people look at us in the world? And what kind of image are we communicating out to the world? And if I look back on the time I spent proudly as an American diplomat, I think the point that Cameron makes is an important one, which is that, you know, we have, it seems to me, a responsibility to speak out in this world about certain basic fundamental principles, and not one at a time, but as he said, holistically. And you know, I think about the things that we should be for. And you think about in Afghanistan and Pakistan. When people said to me, "You're trying to tell us how to live," I said, "No, I'm not trying to tell you how to live. What I'm doing, though, is I'm making an observation. And my observation is that successful 21st century societies will do what? They will honor the sanctity of the individual. They will pay attention to the rule of law. They'll pay attention to the role of women in society. And they'll make it possible for people to make choices in their own lives, particularly in their economic lives." And so it isn't just one thing. It's all of these things. And I think that given our culture, our history, there's nothing wrong with, and we ought to be proud of, being able to say, this is our observation. You can decide how you want to live, but it's our observation. And I think the role of women, hugely important part of that. But the rule of law, the sanctity of the individual, people, the capacity of people to make their own choices, those are the kind of things that we ought to be for, and I think would go a long way toward re-engaging us in a number of societies in that conversation.
One of the questions is more broad, but it gets at a specific point that I think people would benefit from hearing your thoughts about. To what extent is there a millennial generation within Afghanistan and Pakistan that will see things differently, that will capture some of the points that you just made, Mark, and that may undergird a more optimistic view of the future of Afghanistan and Pakistan?
I'm often accused of being way too optimistic, so let me pour a little cold water on it now. I would guard against using a sociological category that I associate with Western Europe and North America in a place like Pakistan. That is to say, a millennial generation, if you assume somehow that people coming into a square in Egypt who are using Twitter are therefore the same as people who are in Silicon Valley trying to innovate with new kinds of technologies, they may have similar aspirations, they may have similar styles, but there can be it gets in the way if you assume that it's the same. So to use the notion of a millennial generation and to put one's hope in that is something I would be very, very careful about. Rather, what I would say is there are certain groups in society, whether or not you clump them by their age or by their income bracket, by their ethnic group, by their beliefs, there are certain people who have, in the broadest sense, progressive ideals. They're not always the loudest. And so when you have fewer and fewer, thanks to the collapse of the American view of world media, when you have fewer and fewer foreign correspondents who have the chance to get out and report to all of us about what's happening overseas, yes, you hear the voices of the most strident or the most injured, but underneath the surface, there are people of goodwill who share the basic notions in some way of this progressive vision that Mark has outlined. I wouldn't limit them to millennial. I would not focus so much that we have a cadre of people who quite kind of think like we do. No, they think like they do. They may have some things that are in common with us. But part of, I think, being a diplomat, and it's not just diplomats, it's anyone who has contact overseas, is, of course, you have to see it through their eyes. You have to see it through the different elements, that the prisms through which other people, young people, business people, are seeing their world, and to assume a category that somehow a westernized, I'm not accusing you of this, Neil, but a westernized group of shock troops of modernity who are out there just like what we have, I think it's very dangerous. You have to be very, very careful to look at the context in a country like Pakistan, which is not like other countries. But what country is? What country is just like any other country? We have to take them on their own terms and be careful about predicting how a certain class will work, I think.
I think maybe just to take where Cameron left off, I was trying to think of, if it's not millennials, if it's the group of people, which I think Cameron is right, what would you call that group? And I guess you'd call them globalized people. I mean, to think a little bit about Tom, the kind of work that Tom Friedman has been doing and speaking. They're globalized people, and I think that's not necessarily an age group. That is an attitude toward being connected to the rest of what's going on. In Afghanistan, I'd say you see it in three places. One, you definitely see it in media. Again, you go back to 2002-03, where there were, what, two TV stations and a radio station in Afghanistan. And as I said to you, now you have 1,000 newspapers, 50 TV stations, 150 radio stations. And the people you meet there, when you go to give an interview or you meet them in a group, yes, they're younger, but what really describes them is they're globalized. They're connected to the rest of what's going on. So in media, I think you do see a difference in Afghanistan. Second group of people, and some of them are the same, obviously, is our entrepreneurs. And here again, as I say, the most interesting group of people you meet in Afghanistan, female entrepreneurs, but that's a range of people from younger people to, you know, slightly older people. So that's a mindset rather than an age group. But so secondly, in the kind of business world, in the entrepreneur world, you see it. And thirdly, one of the things that really struck me in Afghanistan, and here Cameron, it's maybe more age than globalized, is younger people in Afghanistan, when you talk to them, they'll say to you, I'm an Afghan. They don't say I'm a Tajik. They don't say I'm an Uzbek. They don't say I'm a northerner. Younger people will say, I'm an Afghan. I have an Afghan passport. And there I do think there's kind of an age issue. And if you think long term about the future of Afghanistan, that's an important thing. So globalized people in Afghanistan, but I do think there's a change in the younger people about how they consider their ethnicity and their nationality.
Just to shift a little bit, can you talk a little bit about why the discussions with the Taliban failed, and are there prospects for improvement in the next round?
Well, I was given the job. Those of you who follow this will remember that Secretary Clinton gave a speech to the Asia Society in February of 2011. And she said at that time that you need to support the military surge that at that time was going on, that there was a civilian surge of Americans and internationals in Afghanistan that needed to be supported. And at that time we had about 1,500 civilians in Afghanistan working on all kinds of different questions, that we needed a right relationship with Pakistan. But she said there was a missing piece in American diplomacy at that time, and there was no diplomatic surge. There was no diplomatic campaign on Afghanistan to try to bring an end to this conflict. And we divided it into two parts. First was to try to meet the challenge that Cameron talked to you about, which was try to create a regional structure for Afghanistan. And our headline was Secure, Stable, Prosperous Afghanistan Inside of a Secure, Stable, Prosperous Region. And that's why we pursued the major international meetings in Istanbul and Bonn and Chicago, Tokyo, 2011 to 2013, the New Silk Road, to create this regional structure. We also wanted to create it, and the second job she gave us was to see if it were possible, didn't know, but if it were possible, to have some conversation with the Taliban. And it turned out it was possible, that there were people who were in the political wing of the Taliban who were prepared to have a conversation with us, and I tried to carry on that negotiation for the better part of a year and a half. We consulted closely with the Pakistanis and obviously with the government of Afghanistan, because the only reason that we wanted to have this conversation with the Taliban was to open the door so that Afghans could talk to other Afghans about the future of Afghanistan. Excuse me. Our object was to see if we could negotiate a series of confidence-building measures that at the end of which would be this direct negotiation between the government of Afghanistan and Taliban. We didn't succeed. So why didn't we succeed? Well, we didn't succeed, I think, on the Taliban side for a couple of reasons. One is that some analysts believe that in the spring of 2012, Afghan fighters, the people who were fighting for the Taliban in Afghanistan, were starting to say to their leaders, what am I fighting for if there are people negotiating with the Americans, with the enemy, somewhere in the Gulf? I'm not so motivated anymore. It was also hard for both of us to focus in on these confidence-building measures because we got focused in on prisoners. You know, they have an American soldier, Bo Bergdahl, who they've captured since 2009. We've been trying to get back. They wanted people out of Guantanamo. We were never able to kind of make those things mesh. It turned out, thirdly, both for the Taliban and for us, it's very hard to fight and talk at the same time. Very difficult. No, it's a very difficult thing. Because while you're trying to talk to the Taliban, those same people are killing American soldiers, Afghans, civilians and soldiers. They're killing internationals. They're killing people who are there. So how do you do this? Mrs. Clinton said in her speech that we recognize the moral ambiguity, and believe me, I recognized it as well, and that you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. That somehow this war has to end politically. And so we tried. We failed. In March of 2012, the Taliban cut these negotiations off with me. They said I was inconsistent and didn't have a good policy and was, you know, too much in the pocket of the Afghans. Well, you know, the Afghan government is our ally in this, so sorry, but that was true. And they didn't want to talk, and nobody has really talked to them since. You can see, though, Neil, that the administration is still interested in this by the attempt to open a Taliban office in Qatar last summer. And you remember that the Taliban overreached by trying to call it the Office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is out of bounds, because this implies that there's some kind of alternative government. When you say to me, are there prospects? I think there are prospects. But I think there are only prospects if the Taliban see a successful election, a bilateral security agreement, some international force that's left there on January 1, 2015. As you said before, and the question implied, the Afghan government starts to deal with some of the problems like governance and corruption. And they will come to conclude that they're not going to win this militarily, that perpetual war is not the answer, that Afghans are not going back to 2001, 2002, 2003. So someone is going to talk to the Taliban again. I think there would still be interest on the part of the United States, I don't know this, to try to open the door for Afghans to talk to other Afghans about the future of Afghanistan. But at some point, Afghans are going to have to sit down and figure this out and figure out what their society is going to be like in the future. I hope that when that time comes, that it's done from great strength on the part of Afghans so that it's the Taliban, don't forget, that has to accommodate to the future. I'm sorry, it's the Taliban that has to accommodate to the changes in Afghanistan since 2001, 2, and 3, not the other way around.
Thank you very much, Mark. Let me turn things, a number of questions that really are directed at you, Cameron, with respect to...
Let me just add...
Or do you want to respond?
Yeah. Just that's why Mark's job was so much harder than my job, right, during that time.
Well, one of these questions might make your job a little harder. That is having to do with the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and prospects for Pakistan's use of nuclear weapons in a future conflict with India.
In a very general sense, even as we have had very difficult times with Pakistan over the last years, and I, you know, point out to you how much fun it was to try to get Raymond Davis out of jail and to cope with the response to the Abbottabad raid and to deal with the so-called Salalah incident and other things. These were very difficult times, and I remember trying to come up with a metaphor of how do you describe how difficult it was, and I thought of my childhood in Southern California about one time when I fell off a trail and there were cactus and rocks, and you kept rolling down the hill and hoping that there was a ledge and there was none. That was kind of what it was like. So I take it back, Mark. It was pretty. But despite the difficulties of that period, we, in international diplomacy, not everything ends. Not all things simply go blank. Our ability to try to keep a dialogue open, to keep a dialogue open with the Pakistanis remained, and especially on an issue that matters to them and matters to us, which is the safety of nuclear weapons. So we have tried to keep that door open to discussion, to try to be as constructive as we can. And I think in the long run, as our relationship builds back up from those days, we'll continue to talk with them to offer whatever kind of help we can to try to say, you know, this is something that is a worldwide issue and that we want to be as helpful as we can to make sure their nuclear weapons are secure. Now, Pakistani nuclear weapons, people say, well, what about the Taliban getting in and stealing one of these weapons? We don't think it's likely. We think that it's something we have to guard against. We have to be very careful about the social changes taking place in the Pakistani army. It looks from the outside like the Pakistani army is this big monolithic thing. It's not. It's an institution like any institution that's undergoing change. But I think, certainly I felt when I was in Pakistan, that the kind of discipline that that army exercised over its nuclear weapons was satisfactory, was good. Now, in the long run, what the biggest challenge here to me is not a question of people with beards running around with nuclear weapons, stealing these things somehow and using them. The long run, the problem is that the weapons are there because of that doctrine that Pakistan has, that it is threatened by India. At the root of this is Pakistan continues to have a nuclear program because it believes, or at least it is following this precept, that India is a threat. You don't really need nuclear weapons against the jihadis. It's not really an effective way to fight the jihadis. So it is that level that we should address if we want to be helpful, in addition to our general offer to try to say anything that we can do to try to make sure that the physical security of your nuclear weapons remains, we want to do. But in an active sense, contributing to the opening, the thaw between India and Pakistan, small as it might be, is the way ultimately to address this. That we try to support the confidence-building measures that have grown up between India and Pakistan, the onions across the border this way, cement across the border this way, more visas for teachers, for business people, perhaps a demilitarization of Sachem Glacier or some of the border issues on the sea. That is, to build the kind of confidence that the Pakistanis and Indians can even maybe someday get to the discussion that they should have about the future of Kashmir. I think that this, it's not so much a bank shot, but it's just, this is the cause of the issue of what is eventually going to happen to Pakistani nuclear weapons. And I think that we should be ready to be as helpful as we can to Indian and Pakistani efforts to try to make that tension go down. I think we're going in the right direction. And I'm hoping that that will become the focus of Western and American policy as we address the very real challenge of nuclear weapons in the future.
Just to add one more hotspot item, since we've got you on the hot seat, I know a lot of people have asked questions about the effects of the drone strikes and where that leaves us at this stage.
Yeah, drones, like any weapon, these things, as I was mentioning about the nuclear weapons, they don't exist in a vacuum. There's a counter-terrorist struggle that the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan share. When the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan work best together, or even the United States and Pakistan in a bilateral way, you begin to understand what are the tools that these countries have in order to fight that particular threat. In the best of worlds, we would be able to be utterly open and to talk about intelligence sharing and to talk about military cooperation and to talk about the ways in which many of us actually had hoped we would be dealing with this threat. And if there is a tool, like drones, that tool would be used judiciously and it would be used in a way that, because of the technical advantages it might have, that helps achieve that strategic goal. What has happened is that the debate about drones has become a political debate. It's been a debate in which Pakistanis try to express their sense of humiliation and powerlessness. And this is a deep problem in Pakistan that goes far beyond drones. It goes back to the results of a post-colonial heritage and all of those questions that people talk about when you talk about that sense of helplessness that people have, that somehow decisions are being made beyond their power. So we have let this discussion about drones become a political one. It would be wise for us, if we can build that friendship back with Pakistan, to allow drones to be part of a broader and more judicious counterterrorism strategy where everyone is working together against what is actually the common goal, which is eradicating terrorism in that country.
Before moving to questions from the floor, I think we have time for a couple more questions, one for both of you, and this is shifting away. So I'll let you off the hot seat for a moment, Cameron, but thanks very much. And this question is, how can the private sector work in a place where business people don't feel safe? And so this brings up the broader question of private investment in both countries as we look down the road in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, let me take Afghanistan first. Safety is obviously a huge and important question for Afghanistan. People don't want to send their employees to someplace that's not safe. Got it. But it was really interesting to me that after the U.S. Geological Survey did some work in Afghanistan and found actually there a fair amount of minerals in Afghanistan, particularly rare earth minerals in Afghanistan. We went out to a number of American and international companies, and we said, would you work there? And you know, Neil, they said, yes, the security question is an important one. But what was by far the more important question to them was rule of law. Because they already work in challenging places. They know how to deal, in some cases, with the questions of security. But what really, really held them back was rule of law. Is there a minerals law? What happens if I get in trouble? If I go to the courts, do I stand a chance? You know, am I able to move my money back and forth? And so, yes, the security question is an important one, but my experience was rule of law, especially commercial law, much more important question. It's one of the reasons, to go back to Cameron's original points, that we were so insistent on thinking through this new Silk Road to connect Central Asian economies with South Asian economies, with Afghanistan and Pakistan in the center. Because we thought that if you could do that, Afghanistan and Pakistan first would benefit from some transit trade, and then there'd be some experience, some law would build up, and that over time, there'd then be foreign direct investment and a more sustainable economy in both places. And that was certainly true of Afghanistan. So security, yes, absolutely. Rule of law, even more important.
I couldn't agree more for Pakistan as well. American companies are in Pakistan. They make very good money. American businesses know how to deal in places like Nigeria. I mean, they've just as Mark said, they've been around the block. They don't like the security issues. And what is sad to me is when innovative American firms, smaller firms, firms that maybe have some new ideas, look at a place like Pakistan or perhaps Afghanistan, they're scared off by some of the security issues. The bigger firms have an advantage here. They have more experience. But make no mistake, the question that American businesses talk about is the sanctity of a contract going to last? What can I expect? What is the future going to be? And where I'm optimistic about this is there's a fair amount of dammed up demand of enthusiasm for what Mark described as Silk Road, what I would call as kind of the South Asian market, whatever you want to call it. You always end up having people say, I would like to, as a businessman, invest in South Asia, in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, without these borders, trying to look at a way in which you can globalize the way that you approach this area, rather than having to have the specific deal that you feel, the threat of corruption or other kinds of things. Opening up the countries is kind of the other half, I think, of the establishment of this rule of law that's so necessary.
It's interesting how kind of diplomacy works in this regard. When I took over the job as Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, somebody gave me, they said, here's some numbers to remember. Among the numbers that really stick with me all these years later is 2%. 2% was the percentage of Pakistan's exports that went to India. So you live next door to one of the great economic success stories of the last 20, 25 years, and 2% of your exports go there. Well, there are structural reasons for that, all kinds of reasons. And one of the things that Dick Holbrook started, and I was honored to finish, and people thought we were nuts, but we spent a huge amount of time on something called the Afghan-Pakistan Transit Trade Agreement. They'd negotiated this thing for 40 years. And Dick really pushed it forward, and Cameron and I were lucky enough to be there when it was finished. And people would say, what are you spending so much time on this for? We said, look, if there's no capacity to move across this border with goods, how are we going to go Central Asia to India? How are we going to move these goods? How are we going to change perceptions? And as I say, this isn't just a matter of the economics. It's a matter of, Cameron said, of how you change people's minds, how you change their strategy. You know, one of the things that we always hoped was that if we could open a dialogue with Pakistani business people about the possibilities of doing business in India, that when they went up to Islamabad and knock, knock, knocked on the door of their government, they would say, could somebody please think again about our policy toward India, because we'd like to get into some business relationship with these folks. So that's why when we've talked this last hour about the diplomacy is an integrated whole that you can no longer just proceed by saying, well, we've got a political strategy, an economic strategy, a military strategy, a social strategy. They're all connected. They have to be pursued simultaneously. And one of the things we tried to do in Afghanistan and Pakistan was live up to that requirement. So everything we were doing was related to everything else and trying to bring progress, first of all, for the United States of America, but also some progress for people in that region.
There's too little time to answer all of the good questions that came from the floor. I would like to note that many of them came from students who always form an important part of World Affairs Council activities. And I wish we could just keep going on that, but we do want to open the floor up to allow people to ask questions directly. So let me turn things over to you from the floor and wait for a mic. I'll recognize you from the chair, and then if you wouldn't mind waiting for a microphone to ask your question. And we'll begin with, well, one right back there, and then we'll move up here. Could you identify yourself, please, before you ask the question?
Yeah, so I'm Zubin. I'm just a student.
Would you mind standing up so we can see you?
Just a student is not a good way to start. A student.
So if education becomes a cornerstone policy of the Afghanis and the Pakistanis, could we say that it would stop the recruitment of the Taliban and or at least slow that down a little bit?
Say it again?
If education and further education for women and children and things like that becomes a cornerstone of Afghani and Pakistani policy, would it stop or slow the recruitment of the Taliban or in the region?
Well, let me just speak for Afghanistan. The Pakistani Taliban, I will leave to Cameron. Yes, that's the goal. I mean, you know, one of the things that strikes me about who goes to the Taliban. Well, first group of people goes to the Taliban are believers. You know, they're really ideological. They want to fight. And there's a percentage of those people, and they're going to fight for a really long time. Right? Second group of people who go to the Taliban are people who need a job. And so I keep coming back and back and back to this economic question. So second way to deal with this, again, in the integrated strategy here, is they need a job. So let's have an economy, less recruits for the Taliban. Third group of people are people who have no educational capacity, no educational opportunity. And so when you say to me, will it stop the recruitment of the Taliban? No, it will not. Will it help us ultimately have the Taliban not run a country like Afghanistan? Yes, it will. And so the education is hugely, hugely important. But again, each of these things are not the whole answer to the entire question. You can't say, if only we would do education, everything else would be fine. That's not the way that's not the way it works. The education, the economy, the counterterrorism, the military structure, the capacity of the United States to answer some of these questions. You know, as Tom, I think, Friedman would say when you read about it, the whole world is working simultaneously today, and the simultaneity of our policy is the key to it. So education, absolutely right, answered all questions, no, but boy, we ought to pursue it as hard as we can.
Let me take, Mark has put this in a broad context, let me try to take this the other direction, kind of becoming microscopic. We came in, I'll give the example of the American effort to come up with the aid after 2008 with the return of the Democratic government, with the so-called Kerry Lugar Berman legislation, which tried to balance what we had done, the investment we'd made in Pakistani counterterrorism and military aid, with the long-term structural kind of stability effort that would make Pakistan a prosperous state in the long run. And the problem is that we then created the category among our priorities was education. It's not enough to say education. When you dig down beneath that, you have to say this is a very large country with enormous diversity, with differences of capacity. The government of the state of Punjab is pretty competent. The government of the state of Balochistan is almost non-existent. And it happens that education is the province of provinces, not of the central government. Okay, let good Americans, let's figure out how these provinces work. You can do a lot of things in Punjab, but they need it less. You can do very few things in Balochistan. They need it more. What about the tribal areas? We can't even get access to some of the tribal areas. So I would be cautious about broad statements of education. Are you talking about primary education? Are you talking about secondary education? Vocational education? Education for girls? Education for boys? What kind of education for girls? 80% of Pakistani medical students are women. 20% of those women go on to practice medicine. Now, that's not an educational problem. You have these very well-educated women. But if you're not practicing medicine because the social structure means that you go back home and raise a family, no, that's the way people in those parts of Pakistan live. But it's not a question of that the education doesn't work. You're training these people. You have schools. It's how the education fits in and where you, as a foreign country, can make the biggest impact and how you can work on the specifics of education to make a difference. So this is another reason why Mark's statement about, yes, it's necessary but not sufficient, It's a step you must take, but not only will it not get rid of the Taliban, you have to think very hard about where you're using your precious dollars to try to have some impact that's going to have a long-term effect. And I would just reemphasize, this has got to be something that we look at in terms of 10 or 20 years, and not how do we get results by tomorrow.
Mitch Gittin. An article probably in New York Times this week said that as the world's middle class increases in size and has appetite for increased medical services, there's a terrible looming shortage of narcotics used for alleviation of pain, and it contemplated planting Australia on poppy fields. Aren't there a lot of poppy fields in Afghanistan?
What a great question. Thank you very much. No, I really appreciate that question. It was in the Financial Times. It was on the front page of the Financial Times. And I looked at this and I said, oh my goodness. Because let me go backwards, and you, if you'd allow me. The way this works is, and I know this from having been the ambassador to Turkey, is that poppy is grown legally today in Turkey, in Australia, and in India. Those three countries control the legal poppy market. The poppy is grown, and then it is shipped to various drug manufacturers in the United States and other places, and particularly in St. Louis, where they make morphine and other painkillers. And so, exactly right. So the headline says that these drug companies say, massive new demand, what are we going to do? And it's the Australians who want to increase their percentage of poppy growing. So I said, wait a minute, maybe there's a possibility here. And so I alerted some people who may have some, maybe can think about this a little bit more and say, I'm sure that Australians need this money, and I'm sure Tasmania, which is where this happens, is poor. I got it. But goodness gracious, if you could take a certain percentage of this and apply it to in Afghanistan so that you'd have a combination of legal and illegal poppy, focus on the illegal, it might be able to put some more people to work. So I really appreciate that question. It's exactly right. And I hope somebody who now has some responsibility will take this on. I predict to you, though, it'll be a hell of a struggle, because the three countries that own this, what would it be, an oligopoly, I guess, who own this oligopoly, they'll fight for what they have. But you're right. Afghanistan was what jumped off the page to me.
While I wait for the next question, this just reminds me of when President Reagan made the joke about the little boy who was asked to shovel out the horse shed filled with the leftovers from the horse. And he did it quite eagerly, and he went in there and cleaned everything out. And the farmer said, well, why are you so happy to do this? And he said, well, with all of this, you know what, in here, there must be a pony somewhere. Thank you for your question. We have another one from the front here.
Hi, my name's Garrett Bernson. I'm a veteran fellow. I spent about 2 years in southern Afghanistan in Kandahar. While I appreciate the optimism on Afghanistan, I have a question as to why you're so optimistic. Particularly, it seems like a lot of this is under kind of pinned by better governance, and I see very little reason why there would be improved governance in the next 10 years, particularly in Afghanistan. I mean, outside of Kabul, you know, in southern Afghanistan, where my experience was there was almost zero governance.
Right.
So why do you think what's the driving factor between them that will make it better, essentially?
Yeah. Well, first, thank you for your service, and we thank all of the people who've served in Afghanistan and in Iraq and elsewhere these hard years. Afghanistan, a little bit like the point that Cameron just made about Pakistan, Afghanistan's not the same geographically. I don't pretend that what's happening in Kandahar is the same thing that's going to happen in Kabul. But my observation in the country as a whole is that there is now a core group of human beings who say, I'm not going back to 2001. I don't want to live like I lived in 2001. I'm not going back. And what are the requirements for not going back? Among the requirements is that we need better governance here. So really interesting statistic. 77%, I think, of people in this last Asia Society poll say that this election that's happening on the 5th of April is going to have a positive impact on their lives. Interesting. So if that's true, then it becomes a requirement of the next people who govern Afghanistan to sort of do something about this. So if you look out 10 years, will life in Kabul, Mazar-e-Sharif, Herat be different than it is in Kandahar?
Yeah, probably.
Will a rural area outside of Mazar-e-Sharif be in a slightly different situation than a rural area outside of Kandahar?
Probably.
But to set as a goal, seems to me at this point in 2014, to set as a goal that 100% of Afghanistan has to look 100% the same way, it's too hard. It's not possible. It sets a standard. I don't think that's achievable. I think what's achievable is that they're not going back, they'll fight, and that more people than not will want the kinds of changes that they're looking for in Afghanistan.
As always, we have more questions than we do time. So let me just stop at this point and offer Cameron and Mark very brief opportunity to say final words.
Final point, and I'll just jump in at that one as well. As someone who worked at a PRT in Iraq and saw this firsthand, I think one of the problems we have is that we, in our efforts to try to be constructive in the building of governance, especially in contested areas like Kandahar, or in my case, when we were in Mosul, what we did is we tried to use methods and people who are probably not the best methods and people. I mean, to put it bluntly, I think we have done many of our soldiers a disservice by trying to put them into the business of nation building. I mean, we would like to see that we in the diplomatic corps could get better at this, recruit different kinds of people. So I think part of the difficulty we have, it's not that we caused this difficulty, but I'm not sure that we used the right tools to deal with the question of governance in a place, say, like Kandahar, where methods like using SERP money, to me, SERP money is crack cocaine. It's a bad thing, you know. And I'm sorry, because it was people meant to do things that were right, but I'm not sure that we were able to deal with it. It just gets back, in my mind, to the idea that if we're going to support that vision that Mark outlined, we're going to have to do it using tools that look very long-term, that don't look for results by the next fighting season, and that look at trends that are very, very fundamental. It's going to be very hard for us because our elected officials want to say, if we're spending money on something, what are the results? I'm not sure. Not only are we not going to see the same results, we may not see appreciable results or consistent results for a very long time. But if we don't stick with it, then we're not doing we're not following up on the efforts that you made and that all of us made over the last years.
Mark, any last thoughts?
No, there's an insistence here on stop, so I just wanted to, Neil, thank you very much for guiding us, and
okay.
Thank all of you for
thank
coming.
Thank you. So on that note, thanks to you, the audience. Thanks to Ambassador Munter, Ambassador Grossman for their comments.